Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show that features the people, the stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm your host today, Greta Anderson, and in the studio with me now is Kay Puttock, our Community Service Appreciation Correspondent. Later in the show, we're going to speak with Beth Wessel-Crochelle about some of the legislation that has been passed and waiting for the governor's signature and the process that got it there. So that's something to look forward to. But for now, let's talk to Kay. Hi, Kay.
Hello.
So you have been doing these community service appreciation segments for several months now, right?
Yeah, well, and with help from Roxanne Thompson, who did it mostly when I was away. But this week, we're featuring the National Center for Adoption. As you can tell by the name, this is a national agency. But you might say it's headquarters for here in Ames because its executive director, Diana Baltimore, lives right here in Ames. And we'll be hearing my interview with Diana in a minute or two. I just want to remind our listeners, though, who we've featured so far on this program segment. We featured the Heartland Senior Services, NAMI CI, that's the Central Iowa branch of the National Alliance for Mental Illness, Youth and Shelter Services, concentrating on just two programs of YSS. One of them was called GRIP, which stands for Great Relationships in Pairs. It's an in-school mentoring program. And AMP, Achieving Maximum Potential, a program for system youth, that is youth who've been involved with the court system, for example, because they've suffered abuse or neglect. And most recently, we featured ACCESS, the Assault Care Center, extending shelter and support. We get the word out about these community services, what they offer, and the ways community members can help, for example, by volunteering, what kind of work is available for volunteers, and so on. And in addition to the interviews, like the one we're going to hear now, we do public service announcements. But now let's listen to Diana Baltimore, like the city of Baltimore, who's the executive director of the National Center for Adoption. I should say, actually, or emphasize at the outset, that Diana's organization is not a child-placing agency. It's a networking forum, an advocacy group for people who've been involved in adoption in any way, people who are thinking about adopting a child, someone who was adopted themselves, has been thinking of being involved in adoption in any way.
Okay.
I'm here with Diana Baltimore, who's the executive director and the founder of National Center for Adoption. Thank you so much for coming, Diana.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
You founded this organization, and you're also the executive director, and it's a completely volunteer position. Would you like to tell us what inspired you to do this?
Sure. Well, first of all, I am adopted, and my daughter is adopted, and I am in reunion with my birth family, and my birth father was adopted also. So to begin with, we found out we have three generations of adopted individuals in our family. But when I went back to earn my master's and PhD at Iowa State in the Department of Human Development and Family Studies, I needed to choose a research topic. And I have so many interests, and adoption wasn't even on my radar at that time because it was just such a normal part of my life that I never really thought about it being something special. But as I talked to people, they kept saying, well, why wouldn't you just research adoption? You know, this is part of your life. And so that's how I got started. I mean, obviously, I've been interested in it, but then through my research, it really invigorated me.
And what were some of the things you found out?
Interestingly, my first research project involved interviews with parents who had adopted individuals before the age of 18 months. Mm-hmm. And so I interviewed the parents, and then I interviewed the children who were between the ages of 5 and 14 at that time. One of the things that all of the parents said was that they really thought that there needed to be more education about adoption, about the process, what it means to be a birth parent, what it means to be an adoptee, what it means to be an adoptive parent. So that was one of the things that they said. And then they also said that they really felt that people needed to understand appropriate or accurate adoption terminology because there are a lot of words that people use that you know,
inappropriate.
Right, exactly. Or maybe offensive. The adoptive parents said all of this information, you know, that they wanted information about how to find family members who have been separated via adoption. They wanted information out there about the process. And then they also wanted a form in which to share personal experiences for the individuals who have been adopted and adoptive parents and birth parents, because there are a lot of misperceptions or a lot of information that people don't know. So I took that information and decided that I would determine whether or not adoptees or individuals who had been adopted also felt the same way or had the same recommendations. And so I studied college students who were adopted, and I had 175 college students. They were from a multitude of, I mean, there are many different types of adoption, from step-parent, domestic, foster care, kin, which was, you know, a family adoption, surrogacy.
Now, right there you've used a term I didn't really understand.
Okay.
You said foster, domestic. What does domestic mean?
Domestic would be any individual who was born in a particular country and adopted within that same country. Yes. So I was adopted domestically. So was my daughter and so was my birth father. So yes, there's a lot of different types of adoption. So any individual who self-reported as having been adopted was able to complete the survey. So we had a wide range of individuals from, and you know, transnational is one that I didn't mention, but we did have a good representation from individuals who had been adopted from other countries. And interestingly, the overwhelming majority had the exact same ideas and recommendations. So even the adult adoptees were saying the same things as the adoptive parents, that we need, you know, more information about adoption terminology, how to find family members, the process for everybody involved, birth parents, adoptees. They wanted a form in which they could share their experiences so that others could read about it. And the overwhelming majority of individuals who completed my survey indicated that they felt that adoption was a positive option and had greatly enhanced their overall health and well-being as a result of having been adopted. So one day I was getting all of my research together for a national conference so that I could present that information. And I thought, you know, what am I doing with these recommendations other than, you know, going to national conferences and sharing it with other scholars, researchers, possible practitioners? So one day I thought, you know what? I need to honor all of these participants' recommendations. So I decided to create a nonprofit organization. And again, I volunteer all of my time. Everybody who works with me volunteers their time. Right now, we have the website that allows for all of those interactions to take place that they had recommended. And recently, we collaborated with a few organizations in the state of Iowa. And one was AMP, Achieving Maximum Potential, Iowa KidsNet, Variety the Children's Charity, and Youth and Shelter Services. And we hosted our first adoption promotion event. Initially, we thought it would be an event to just promote all different types of adoptions, and it turned out to be a really nice initial fundraiser for all of us. And we also had more than 250 participants and raised over $3,700. Yes, everybody kept telling us, oh, don't expect more than, you know, maybe 20 or 40 people. And it really affirmed for all of us the extent to which adoption touches many, 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 many lives. And I have to say that when we had the walk run, it was the first Sunday in November, and that preceding day was a very warm day, and the next day was not warm. We had 40 mile per hour winds, but we still had 250 people come out and support our cause. We were very happy with our turnout.
So what are some of your proudest achievements, apart from what you've already mentioned?
With our organization, probably one of the biggest, and I was actually just thinking about that before I came up here. Two summers ago, I had the opportunity to introduce an individual a female who wanted to make an adoption plan for her child. And I introduced her to a family who wanted to adopt. And I'm not a child placing agency, and the National Center for Adoption is not a child placing agency, but, you know, everybody associates me with adoption. Mm-hmm. So I'd been contacted by both of these individuals at separate points in time. And ultimately, they decided to meet, and birth mom ended up making an adoption plan, and this baby is now a year old and is with an absolutely wonderful family. Uh-huh. And so that just gives me goosebumps every time I think about that.
So everyone's happy. Now, I presume that most people that want to adopt infants. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Yes.
The majority.
Mm-hmm. And how about adopting older children? Have you had any experience with that, or is there anything you can talk about from your research about that?
Yes. Actually, there is a lot of research, including my own research, that indicates that there are literally millions of Americans who wish, just like you said, to adopt infants. However, there are only approximately 12,000 infant adoptions that occur in the United States each year, because there aren't many individuals.
Yeah.
Well, there are actually a lot of births. It's just that there are a lot of individuals who do not choose to voluntarily relinquish their children. And in the United States right now, there are more than 100,000 children in foster care who are legally available to be adopted. And right here in Iowa, we have 800 children who are waiting to be adopted from foster care. So these are situations where, you know, their parental rights have been terminated due to either, you know, neglect, abuse, whatever. And so we're really trying to do a good job of getting information out there about the fact that indeed in Iowa there are 800 children whose parental rights have been terminated and need families. On the flip side, we also want to present adoption as an option for individuals. And I've talked to many whose children have been removed from their care. And these individuals said, if I would have known that I could have made an adoption plan for my child, I would have done that hands down. But no one ever told me. I had no idea that I could do that.
What exactly is an adoption plan?
Okay. Well, that is the accurate terminology for what most people would consider placing a child for adoption. But when you use the term making an adoption plan, it assumes that the individual has made a conscious decision and has planfully decided and weighed maybe the pros and cons of parenting versus adoption and the best interests of all parties involved, the adoptive parents, the birth parents, and the child. And then they work with someone. Oftentimes they work with someone. They don't necessarily have to, but they can work with an agency and make some sort of a plan to relinquish their child at the birth.
Do they get any say about the kind of home this child will go to? Or?
In many cases, yes. Now, times have changed a lot, so that's a great question, Kay. Now, there are many organizations who are allowing the birth parents to choose the adoptive parents.
And say things like, say they're musical, I want them to go to a musical.
Exactly. Family. Yes. Yeah, that's extremely common. Actually, interestingly, today I received an email from someone who knows what my passion is, and this individual is also adopted, and she said, I work with someone who is very much in favor of making an adoption plan for her child who is yet to be born. It's a situation where, you know, they can't afford to care for a child. And so when I leave here, I'm going to call and talk to those individuals and help them at least explore their options. I'm a firm believer that no one should ever be coerced or forced, or, you know, that's, it has to be their own decision. Knowing the options is huge.
Right. When these parents say, though, I have no idea I could do an adoption plan, that seems very strange to me. I mean, everyone has heard of adoption.
Well, it happens very frequently, as a matter of fact. I mean, half of all pregnancies in the United States are unplanned, which is millions. But no one typically, except for if you're in this field, talks about, you know, what do you do for those individuals?
at least in the old days when I was young, if someone's a single parent,
right, they might think, exactly.
But if they're married, they might not think that's an option.
Exactly. Well, and even today now, of course, we've seen that shift where, mm-hmm. I mean, there are millions of individuals who are single parents, who are unwed mothers and or fathers rearing children that they may or may not be able to afford,
right,
or know how to parent, or that they're too young.
Right. Even people like that don't realize that the adoption is an option.
Mm-mm. Nope. And I cannot tell you how many times I have talked to physicians, OB-GYNs, social workers, adoption counselors who hear that still to this day very frequently. I had talked to one person who has been very vocal and very open, so she doesn't mind me sharing, but she said, I was homeless and I was pregnant. And she said, I was in the hospital and I said, I cannot parent. And they told me, you'll be fine. And she goes, and I had to take my baby to a homeless shelter, and we struggled and struggled and struggled. So
you're getting the word out, as you say.
Right. There are many, 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 many individuals who would like to have a baby.
Do you have any success stories of adoptions with older children?
Oh, yes. Yes. I have a really good friend who has adopted, oh my goodness, probably about 15. I think she's up to 15 children. They were all older child adoptions.
Wow.
Yeah. Many, many, many success stories.
Mm-hmm.
But on the contrary, I do have to say that one of the things that we're going to be doing as an initiative this year with that group that we collaborated with to create the Walk Run fundraiser is that we are going to be putting together, hopefully, some educational trainings to educate individuals about adoption disruption and or disillusion, because there have been more cases recently where individuals have started either the adoption process of children typically older, and they've decided that they can't go through with it, or there have been situations where they've actually finalized the adoption and then
felt they couldn't cope.
Exactly. And actually, my friend has adopted 3 individuals who have had more than one adoption, either disruption or dissolution. So we feel very strongly that we need to educate people. There's a lot of research, which is why I started my research with individuals who had adopted children who were younger than 18 months, because there's a lot of research that shows that if you're adopted before 18 months versus after 18 months of age, those individuals have a higher propensity of having ADHD, behavioral problems, intellectual deficits, all related to having an increase in pre-adoption adversities, you know, neglect, abuse, inadequate education. So we hope that by getting the word out, there'll be more individuals who see it as an option and a viable option, and one that actually I strongly believe that birth parents should be very much celebrated from my own standpoint, as well as, you know, my birth father said the same thing. We've all been in reunion with our birth family members, and we know that our lives were much better off.
Yeah, because it's a thoughtful decision.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and talking of getting the word out, you can find all this information that Diana's been talking about at their website, all one word, the National Center for Adoption.org.
Yes.
So terminology and email addresses.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And anything you might want to know there.
Yes, and we are on Facebook. You can find us at the National Center for Adoption on Facebook, too. We're always in need of volunteers.
Well, thank you so much for coming in to talk to us today.
Oh, thank you.
And once again, you can find a lot of information about this on the website, the National Center for Adoption, or one word, thenationalcenterforadoption.org. I've been talking to Diana Baltimore, who's the founder and an executive director of the National Center for Adoption.
Thank you, Kay.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson. I'm here with Kay Puttock, who did that interview with Diana Baltimore.
Yes, and as Diana was just talking about her website, I should emphasize that all of us, including those not directly involved with adoption, could probably benefit from looking at this website. It alerts us all to acceptable and unacceptable terminology. For example, I didn't really know this at all before. You shouldn't talk about giving up a child for adoption. You should say make an adoption plan. And you shouldn't say my own child, as in contrast to an adopted child. You should say my birth child and my adopted child and so on. And there's lots of little wrinkles like that that can make us more sensitive to this kind of thing. So it's useful for everybody.
That does sound very useful. We'll link to it on our website, khoifm.org. Well, thank you, Kay. I'll see you next month, I guess. Mm-hmm.
So do ya no poil you company on Good Sababu himself I say nice I say no block you company way Happiness himself is so sweet Not on the next man enjoy into sorrow You know able hell no poil
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host, Greta Anderson, and we were just listening to the Sierra Leone's Refugees All-Stars. And this is one of the groups that we just found out last week is going to be performing at AIM's July 4th celebration. They'll be actually playing on July 4th. And at the very end of the hour, we have Nate Logsdon. He's going to tell us about that band and other bands that will be performing. So that's to stay tuned for. Right now, we have Beth Wessel-Crochelle in the studio. She is the representative for District 45, which is basically Ames, right?
Yeah, it includes the 1st and 3rd Ward in Ames, and then I go all the way to Nevada and down to Kelly and include Kelly also.
Welcome to the show, Beth.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And you have been busy.
Very busy.
In the legislature. I heard that the last night of the session, which would be April 30th, went all the way until May 1st.
May 1st at 6 o'clock in the morning. That's right.
What were you discussing?
Well, predominantly, we were working on bills that have to be done, and that would be our budget bills. So you have to do health and human services. We may have done the night before, standings, what we call the Christmas tree bill. Almost anything can go on to that. And then two kind of surprise issues came up the last evening, and one of them was cannabis, which had been spoken about a lot during the session, but we didn't know where it was going to go. And the other one was the decriminalization of HIV.
Right. I really admire the ability of the legislature to listen to the citizen lobbies. They were very small but forceful groups who were promoting these laws or changes of laws.
That's right. I think the HIV bill had a pretty good group of people, some experienced, some very inexperienced. It was a small but strong group. And the cannabis bill had different groups. I mean, there are so many different areas where we think cannabis might help, but the epilepsy group is the one that prevailed.
Right. So tell me a little bit more about the cannabis oil bill. It turns out that cannabis oil can only be used by people with epilepsy?
Correct.
In the state of Iowa.
I have a lot of concerns about that bill because you can't buy or sell or produce cannabis or cannabis oil in Iowa. That's still illegal. If an Iowa neurologist recommends that an individual use cannabis for a particular kind of epilepsy, a really severe and rare form of epilepsy, then usually the family is going to have to travel, and mostly we were dealing with children, although the oil will be legal for adults also, I did ask that. They would have to travel to a state where it is legal, and the closest one I can think of is Colorado. My concern there is they have to get it back here. You can't ship it, and so these individuals would have to travel through Nebraska, where it is illegal, or get on a flight, and marijuana is Schedule 1 under federal law, which means you would not be able to travel with it.
That is quite a dilemma, isn't it?
There are a lot of dilemmas. And the only thing I can say about it and the reason I voted for it is that we can say it's a foot in the door.
Right.
And I think we need to get some experience seeing that this isn't as scary as so many people think it is if we use it for medical purposes or to relieve symptoms of a lot of medical issues that individuals have.
Well, I understand the cannabis oil is not in no way intoxicating.
That's what I understand, yes.
Yeah. And there are a lot of illnesses out there that could benefit from cannabis in one form or another.
I have a constituent who has contacted me several times about two joint replacements she's had. One of them went bad, and she had to have it removed from an infection, and she's been through a lot of pain. And she has, of course, illegally been using a vapor. And I don't know where she got it. I didn't ask. But she says she does not get high, but she takes one whiff of this vapor, and the pain goes away where nothing else has been able to address that pain. I think there are lots of different places where we could be using cannabis.
Hmm. And the HIV bill, I understand you had a major role to play in this.
Well, I sponsored that, a bill similar to it. Of course, it went through a lot of negotiations over the course of 2 years. One bill passed out of the Senate committee, never made it out of the Senate a year ago. And that bill died on the Senate floor. It did not have enough support from all the senators there. And then we did, it was reproposed in the Senate. There was a lot of negotiation between the Attorney General's office. The public health had some real concerns about current law. And county attorneys always have their hand in anything that would be criminal related. And then the advocates for individuals who have HIV. Currently, we've been putting individuals in prison and on the sex offender registry for life, prison for 25 years, for exposing somebody to HIV without disclosing that, even though there was no chance of transmitting the disease and no disease was ever transmitted. So that's an old law. The science has changed. We can control the disease. We can control the viral load for HIV patients. And there's very little chance of transmission. The big problem is anybody who does not go in to be tested and won't get treated is likely to continue to transfer the disease to other people.
So this previous law that you repealed required someone who knew that they had HIV to disclose to a partner that that was the case, even if they weren't capable of transmitting it because of the drugs that they'd been taking. If they never tested themselves,
then they're not guilty of anything, but they're also not getting treated, and they are also spreading the disease.
So this law would have been a deterrent for people to get tested.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I read this morning that we're seeing 50,000 new cases across the nation, and most states have a law similar to ours that was passed in the 90s. So we're seeing an increase of 50,000 cases of HIV every year. So if this were truly a deterrent, we wouldn't be seeing that.
Right. So you succeeded in simply repealing the law or changing it?
We repealed the law, and then we did a differentiated cases. For example, if someone intentionally infects somebody with HIV, then they are criminal, and they are subject to 25 years in prison, I think it is. But from there on out, the penalties are very simple. And if an individual is caring for him or herself and is taking precautions, then they would not be considered a criminal. We took disclosure out of the bill completely.
Okay. So that's why they call it the decriminalization of HIV.
Correct.
Law. And so both this law and the cannabis oil are now on the desk of Governor Branstad.
Of the governor. That's right.
And do you have any notion whether he'll sign these or not?
Well, I'm pretty sure he'll sign the cannabis because I think it's some of his supporters who have been very vocal about wanting cannabis oil for their particular form of epilepsy. So I'm pretty sure that one is good. And I'm also fairly comfortable with HIV. The HIV decriminalization bill passed the Senate 49-0 earlier in session, and it passed the House unanimously also. And I can't imagine that he would not sign it, given that some of the most far-right individuals of his party supported that legislation. I did ask his staff, and they are always noncommittal. We like to see the bill before we before the governor determines. I said, well, it's been sitting in the Senate for forever. And I did get a little bit of a affirmation that he didn't see a problem with the bill at this time.
Okay. Well, speaking of the far right, I wanted to ask you, we hear a lot about the ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council.
They're having a convention this weekend, as a matter of fact.
The Koch brothers are often tied with this organization because evidently they've given a lot of money to it. But I understand that ALEC promotes legislation not just at the federal level, but also really gets into the state legislatures and provides sort of ready-made legislation for conservative lawmakers. Is ALEC present in Iowa?
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I think we adjourned on Thursday morning at 6 o'clock because individuals were heading to Kansas City for an ALEC conference. The House has a rule that we can't work past midnight, and we overrode that rule about quarter till midnight on Wednesday. The ALEC conference started, I believe, Thursday sometime. We do see legislation that comes directly from ALEC, although ALEC is a very secretive organization. I know of one Wisconsin legislator who is a Democrat who this is her second year at that conference. I have not ever attended. And she talks about there are certain meetings she can go to and certain meetings she's not allowed to go to. It's hard to trace legislation back to ALEC, but one of the very first bills that we debated in the Iowa House was a tobacco industry bill, which we also believe had ALEC fingerprints on it. I have seen, you know, American Cancer Society and some of the other groups who were trying to prevent that bill from going through had traced it back to ALEC and the tobacco industry. That's sometimes hard to do because when we file a bill, it goes with our name or maybe a departmental name. But they found traces of the tobacco industry and ALEC in this particular bill, which did pass the Iowa House one of the last nights. Well, it passed the Iowa Senate one of the last nights.
So what did this law say?
Well, I mean, it does one good thing. It will keep e-cigarettes out of the hands of minors. So minors won't be able to buy these electronic cigarettes that there's not very much research on them. But it also rewrote the definition of tobacco product, and it was a very complicated rewrite of that definition. And we're concerned that it will mean that new tobacco products and possibly e-cigarettes will not be held to the same standards under our regulation, including our taxes, as they should be. It did not need to be in the legislation to keep e-cigarettes out of the hands of minors, but we were unable to get it out. And the American Cancer Society, the Heart Association, the Lung Association, Public Health, all were opposed to the bill, and they would not have been opposed to keeping e-cigarettes out of the hands of minors.
I see. True. What other kinds of legislation? I know that they frequently become involved in labor issues. We're already a right-to-work state, so did they get involved?
Well, they work very hard to prevent us from ever making any inroads in stronger labor laws for Iowa middle-class workers. And so I have not seen anything specifically, or there's not anything that I know specifically dealing with labor. There are a lot of gun laws that come up that there's suspicion that those come from ALEC. But sometimes ALEC has denied that, like Stand Your Ground a year ago. A year and a half ago, we debated Stand Your Ground legislation.
In Iowa?
In Iowa.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. We also debated saying oh, putting the Second Amendment in the Iowa Constitution, but taking it a step further, saying that no, there could be no regulatory policy, so that you couldn't pass any laws to regulate firearms. So we passed a bill like that out the same night that we did Stand Your Ground. It was a year and a half ago, probably.
Passed through the House, but not the Senate, obviously.
Did not pass through the Senate. This year we did a silencer bill, which passed through the House, and this one was just to allow firearm owners to own silencers, which currently they can't in Iowa. They thought this was the best bill ever, just a small incremental change in Iowa law. But for me, if you look at some of the tragedies that we've seen in the country, and you look in particular at Sandy Hook, I think that if Adam Lanza had had a silencer, there would be more children missing, lost.
Okay, and just to help our our listeners understand, Alec, when we say that it's under suspicion of being promoted by Alec, is there something illegal or wrong going on, or is it just the enormous influence of corporations?
I think it's an enormous influence of corporations, which we have allowed to become so much more powerful in our lives, in our political system. You know, part of it's Citizens United, so there are so few rules regarding corporations. But there, you know, I believe it's unethical. And if we tightened up Iowa's ethic laws and applied it to ALEC, certainly we have tighter restrictions on corporate giving and corporate involvement in the state of Iowa on elections than we have on ALEC. But because it's a nonprofit group, it's different. I mean, ALEC members are taken on trips, to very exotic trips, and their families are often taken on these trips, from what I understand, from what I've read, which is a much bigger gift than a $3 gift, which is what's allowed under Iowa law.
Okay. We've alluded to the fact that the House is Republican, the Senate is democratically controlled, and of course the governor is Republican. How has it been working in this divided House?
This is the fourth year that we have served in this kind of divide. The Democrats made a few inroads 2 years ago. We were at 43 in the House, and now we're at 47. But other than that, there's been very little change. It's been very difficult. And I know last year when we passed Medicaid expansion, how disappointed I was in that bill. First of all, for anyone from 101 to 138%, those individuals will be, the state will be paying for private sector insurance companies to insure them.
Okay, so you're saying 101 to 138% of poverty
federal
rate?
Federal poverty level, I'm
okay.
Sorry. You start talking like this at work and forget.
Right.
Yes, 101 to 138% of federal poverty level will be insured by private industry paid for by the state or paid for by the federal government now. The state will eventually take over some of those dollars. But what it forces us to do is to continuously fight private industry to get the same level of care, and it's $6 million. It will cost the state alone when we pay 10% of the cost. So we will only ever pay 10% of the cost when we are fully invested in this program. It will cost us $6 million a year more to have private industry do it versus have Medicaid provide those services. We also had a clawback in there that said any savings that counties found through the American, the ACA, Obamacare, those savings would have to be shared with the state, with the state would get 80% to 20% for a mental health and disabilities services. Well, we've never fully funded mental health and disability services, and I thought that was just a tragic outcome. Great to have more people covered, but when you have to make those kinds of compromises that I think put people and our programs at risk, and certainly they will cost us more down the road, I have to be very concerned about those. So it's frustrating. On the other hand, we did pass the HIV bill, which I think was very important, and we passed the cannabis bill, which, although so very limited, I do have some concerns about it. I think it is a foot in the door.
And there was a tuition freeze.
We did get a tuition freeze by funding the regents at the level that they asked for. They promised to freeze tuition for the second year in a row, which is so important for families in Iowa and our young people who are trying to get higher education.
And especially in our community.
Absolutely.
I thought that you could talk about the closure of the Iowa Juvenile Home, because that was in the news quite a bit, and it was kind of puzzling. I thought that the judge had ordered it to be reopened, and it wasn't reopened.
The judge did order it to be reopened, but it was appealed to higher court. So I think it actually went directly to the Supreme Court at this point. We did not put money, nor did the governor put money in the budget for the juvenile home. He did put money in the budget for the girls who lost their space at the juvenile home. Unfortunately, there were at least four of those girls who were not ready to leave yet because they escaped. And I don't know if they've been found. Some people speculate that they have become victims now of human trafficking, because we're talking about some very vulnerable young women who are not ready to be on their own. They probably don't have family support, and they may never have had family support. They didn't transition these young women as they needed to be transitioned, and so there are problems with just closing a home for adjudicated girls so quickly. It also included China, so children who were in need of assistance because they didn't have family assistance. Part of the problem with the home is that it had quite a mix. It had the adjudicated young women, it had the China, and then it had some China boys.
Now, China is generally what you would consider foster children.
Correct. And these were difficult enough foster children that they had been through sometimes up to 9 different placements, and that's how they ended up in Toledo. But when you have such difficult children, it's not good to mix boys with girls, and this home did it. And it's probably not a good idea to mix adjudicated girls with China, children in need of assistance, girls. And so there were problems with the school. The school was having a lot of problems providing an education. But just because you're doing a bad job doesn't mean you close a facility. It means you need to take a look at what that facility's doing and make adjustments. The governor chose to close the facility. Now, if you talk to juvenile court officers, they seem to be as clear as possible that we need a place for these really high needs kids, the ones that we just don't have anywhere else for them to go. They say it's always a last choice to send them to Toledo. But when you have no other choice, they need a place like that. Otherwise, we'll be sending them out of state, and it will cost us a lot more money than having a juvenile home for young women.
I've heard there was an effort to expand the waiver system, the mental health waiver system for youth.
Yes. We needed about $12 million to get every child off the waiting list for that, and we, I think, got 8 million dollars.
Wow, so that's a big step.
We made progress. Unfortunately, a year ago, the governor vetoed $8 million, which would have cleared the waiting list at that time. I think he understands now that that wasn't a good idea, and he will sign it this time.
Well, that's good news. Mm-hmm. Anything else you'd like to say?
Well, I think I'm still a little bit in recovery. Going a whole night is a little bit more than what I'm used to staying up, but there was so many good things going on that last night. I have to tell you, it was not hard to stay awake. It was a relatively good session. There were some bad things, there were some good things, but I think in the end, most Iowans would be pleased with how this legislative session went.
Well, that's great to hear. Thank you so much for stopping by, Beth.
Thanks for having me.
I hope you do it again.
I would be happy to.
right. Nate Logsdon of Maximum Ames stopped by the studio. On Thursday, the City of Ames announced the lineup for the 4th of July / 150th birthday party for Ames, and I understand that you were involved in the selection of the bands.
That's correct.
Who contacted you, and what did they ask you for?
Well, the city reached out to Maximum Ames a few months ago to get involved in the process of helping plan the Ames Sesquicentennial Celebration. We're obviously, you know, really honored, wanted to be a part of it because we really represent Ames. We're based in downtown Ames, and we love our community. And so being part of a celebration of Ames' history really appeals to us because we have such strong ties to the community. So we sat down and sort of brainstormed the kind of music that they were looking for. And I think, you know, what they really wanted was something that would be a street party and would be family friendly, fun for people of all ages. And then we also really wanted to bring in something that kind of represents Ames's diversity, cultural and musical diversity, and something that would just be fun. And just and so with the headliners that they announced on Thursday that we booked, I feel that we really achieved those goals. These are all really high energy bands, and they put on incredible shows, and they're musically excellent. And you know, these events are free and open to the public. So I think if you just come out and you're hanging out with your family and you're doing one of the bouncy tents, you know, on the street and getting your face painted during the day, and you want to stick around into the evening, all ages of people, whatever your musical tastes, would find this music to be really fun and really excellent.
Okay, so let's talk about the first band scheduled for the Friday, July 4th, Sierra Leone's Refugee All-Stars. Now, when I think of Sierra Leone, unfortunately, there's a lot of really bad images that come to mind. Mm-hmm. Sierra Leone is a place that's had a lot of bad stuff happen. How does this band identify itself with Sierra Leone?
Yeah, that's a great question. There is there's actually a documentary about this band that kind of addresses that very question, because, like you said, Sierra Leone is in a part of the world that has seen a lot of conflict in our lifetime and for a long time. And actually, this band was formed in a refugee camp. The gentlemen in the band, they met as refugees from Sierra Leone, and they formed a band. Their story is told in this documentary about them. And they became a world-renowned, Grammy-winning ensemble. We've had them a few times at the music venue that I work at, DG's Tap House. And of all the thousands of bands that we've seen come through, this one really, really stands out. They, you know, you would think because they've seen so much, they've been witnesses to atrocities. I mean, they really have in their lifetime. But their music is the most fun, life-embracing, positive, healing experience you could possibly imagine. But on top of that, they put on a party. They really do. They play, their music is fun. They dance. They get the audience doing sing-alongs. They, you know, they have choreographed dance routines that they do, and they play just beautiful, beautiful music. I think the music they play is often kind of referred to as Afropop. It also has a lot in common with reggae. If you're a fan of reggae and you haven't seen this band, they would really, really appeal to you. But I wouldn't call their music strictly reggae. It has a similar tone, but I think it would be more something you would call Afropop. And to us, as well as being just a great show and something that would be a street party, Ames is a really diverse town, especially for Iowa. We have the university here. There are many people that have come through town as students or athletes or for conferences or employees of the university, professors from all over the world, including lots of folks from Africa that live in Ames or in central Iowa. And so, you know, we wanted to represent Ames's diversity and that Ames is a destination for people from around the world, including a band from Africa.
That's great. So you have a relationship with them already through your other job. Is this the band you contacted first?
They actually, yes. This was the first band that we got in touch with when we got this, when we were hired by the city, because, you know, they said, we want a street party, we want something that's fun for all ages, and they just popped into my mind because they are so fun and so suitable to any situation, so easy to work with, and just really, really professional, really bright, warm individuals.
Great.
The following day, July 5th, there are two bands.
Well, actually, on Thursday, the bands that were announced were just the headliners of the 4th and the 5th. There's also going to be local talent all day. So, yeah, there's two stages, and there will be local talent all throughout the day, starting at noon on the 4th and the 5th. And so local bands of every different variety, as well as different performance groups from Ames, all throughout the afternoon on both stages will be representing Ames's local musical and performance heritage. And the on each night, these headliners will perform. And so the on July 5th, there are two headliners. That's going to start at 7 o'clock. And the opening act for the July 5th headliners is Buckwheat Zydeco. You know, Zydeco music is kind of a New Orleans Bayou tradition. It features very polyrhythmic arrangements, horns, call and response. It is very up-tempo. Think of just, you know, New Orleans regional bayou music. And again, this is a Grammy-nominated act. They're known all over the world. They're one of the top proponents of this Zydeco style, which is a New Orleans regional Louisiana style. And this is just an extraordinary act that's been around for decades, and they put on a great show. And they will be opening for Robert Randolph and the Family Band, which is our festival headliner for July 5th. Again, a really up-tempo band, a band that kind of draws on...
another up-tempo band.
Another up-tempo band.
Oh, my gosh, we're going to be sweating.
You're going to be dancing. Yeah, you're going to be dancing and having a great time. But these are also bands that are so musically superb that if dancing isn't your thing, but listening to music or watching a band play is, you will be seeing world-class musicians performing. So, just if you love music, you would love these bands. You know, Robert Randolph and the Family Band is kind of led by a slide guitar player. They kind of draw on American blues traditions, boogie-woogie, they're, you know, kind of traditional rock and roll. They have Hammond organs and, again, a horn section and just a big, fun band led by this extraordinary slide guitar player.
Robert Randolph.
Correct.
That sounds really fun, too. Okay. I presume you will be helping find and place the local talent as well.
Yes. So there's two stages, and we were hired to book one of the stages, which includes all three of these headliners, as well as the local talent that will be performing throughout the day on those stages. And the full lineup will be coming this week.
Oh, great. Mm-hmm. More news that we can share. And on the other stage, what will be going on there?
The other stage, there's like family entertainment performances that are not strictly musical performances, but like different community groups that will be coming and sharing kind of what they do. And there will be some music on that stage as well. So you can walk back and forth between these stages. Everything that happens at this is completely family friendly, participatory, and it'll just be a beautiful celebration of Ames.
Well, we'll have to stick around for the July 4th holiday then. Sounds like it's going to be fun. This is old hat to you in a certain way. You've been doing concerts for how many years now?
I started booking concerts in 2007.
Okay, and then we've had several music festivals, Maximum mm-hmm. Ames. Is that going to continue again this year?
Absolutely. Maximum Ames Music Festival is returning this September.
Great. Well, Ames is very lucky to have someone like you helping to plan our big birthday celebration, so thank you very much.
Well, thanks for saying that, Greta, and I want to say how lucky we are to have KHOI Community Radio, which is one of the partners of Maximum Ames, and we're very lucky to have KHOI not only as a partner of our organization, but as a partner for our town and for our community.
Cool. Well, let's listen to some of that music Nate was talking about. This is Robert Randolph and the Family Band.
Don't matter.
for Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Today we've been talking about adoption with Diana Baltimore, the wrap-up of the legislative session with Beth Wessel-Prichel, and we heard Nate Logsdon tell us about the 4th of July lineup. You can find more information about all of these events and people at our website, khoifm.org. Kay Puttock, I want to thank for contributing to the show and for stopping by, and also James Winters for being ever-present in the studio.
Greta.
The music we heard was Sierra Leone Refugee All-Stars and Robert Randolph and the Family Band. We're listening to them now. Our theme song is Backcrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. You can listen to this show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org, and see listings of our past guests and resource contact information. Your participation as audience is what makes KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.
Thanks, Greta.